It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This episode is brought to you by the Slash and Cast Podcast Network. Learn more at slashandcast.net.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions
apply. See website for details. You're listening to Reverie True Crime, and as always, I'm your host, Paige. I just wanted to mention really quick that I have an official merch store, and it's linked in the show notes. There's always a sale going on, and if there's not a sale at the time you listen to this, you can use the code REVERIE30 for 30% off. Thank you to everyone that has bought anything so far. It's been really great seeing you guys post, text, and email me your merch. It just means so much to me. Y'all are seriously so badass. Also, stay tuned after the episode to hear a promo from the podcast Oklahoma Side. And now we have to get into the sad stuff. Today's episode is about the murders of little Lori Farmer, Denise Milner, and Michelle Gousset in Oklahoma back in 1977. Their lives were tragically taken during a stay at Camp Scott. Some say this is an unsolved case, and some people think it's actually solved. The major source of this episode is a documentary based on a book by Michael Wilkerson, and they're both called Somebody Cry for the Children. It's an amazing documentary. You'll hear a lot of the audio in this episode. I also recommend the book as well. There are links to the documentary and the book in the show notes. Let's dive right into this because there is a lot to tell.
A place where the children felt safe, even though there were dangers that lurked in the nighttime sounds, and they imagined the little beasties, as they called them, the snakes and the rodents traveling amongst the leaves making noise. It was a great opportunity to explore, to be adventuresome, but to always have the companionship of your unit leaders and your friends and the other Girl Scouts in the area. It was, I think, one of the most thrilling places to be for a young woman, where she could grow and explore and stretch herself while living in a group and learning to share friendships and responsibilities and jobs.
Camp Scott in Locust Grove, Oklahoma, which is 40 miles from Tulsa, had been up and running since 1928. The opening day in 1977 was June the 12th. Camp Scott was located in the Cookson Hills, and it is very important in this story that I give you a background of the Cookson Hills, which will come into play as the story unfolds. Sourcing from OKHistory.org, the Cookson Hills are rich in American Indian history. This geographical feature is located in southeastern Cherokee County, the name of the county indicating the group that historically controlled the area. The Cookson Hills were once included in the Cherokee Nation's Tahlequah District. So, Tahlequah was known as the Cherokee capital towards the end of the Trail of Tears. Members of the old Cherokee Nation moved from the southeast because there was a massive amount of pressure to Native American territory, and a lot of Cherokee were made to move on the Trail of Tears. This was back in 1838. So there's a deep-rooted Native American history in Cookson Hills, and still is. It's also important to highlight the beliefs and practices of the Cherokee Native Americans. This will also come into play as we go along. There are numbers that are very important in Cherokee life, as well as rewarding the good, punishing evil, recognizing the powers of animals, and rules for associating with the spirited little people. The Cherokee live by moral, ethical, and religious policies. There's meaning in the aspects of earth and its organic sources, which consist of colors and human traits. One of the numbers that is very important, especially in this case, is the number 4. The number 4 refers to the north, south, east, and west. Cougars and owls are also significant to the Cherokee. They praise these two living beings because they stay awake and alert at night while the others are in a deep slumber. Another thing important to this case are the Cherokee ceremonies and medicine. The uses of cedar, laurel, holly, spruce, and pine are used in these practices. The Cherokee do have medicine men and women. There are bad medicine people, and there are good medicine people. There are various kinds of medicine people, just like there are many kinds of modern doctors that specialize in different types of healing. There are 7, one of the important numbers besides the number 4, that Cherokee who are practicing to become medicine men or women have to know. This is also extremely important to this story. So this is from AAANativeArts.com. Number 1. Herbal Medicine. An in-depth knowledge of 400 to 600 plants, their medicinal and ceremonial uses, as well as the plant's personality. Many apprentices slash medicine people today only know 100 to 200 of these plants and their uses. Number 2. Physical Medicine. Including the unique Cherokee massage using persimmon, wood stampers, moxibustion, minor surgery, and midwifery. Number 3. Dream Work. Not only how to interpret dreams, but how to use them for personal growth, healing, and to gain knowledge. Number 4. Language, Myths, and Laws. Cherokee is a language of amazing subtlety and power. So medicine men and women not only have to know the subtleties of everyday spoken Cherokee, but there's a separate medicine language. Stories, myths, and laws give meaning to the world and help us to understand our place in the great life. Number 5. Ceremonies. The Cherokee traditionally had 7 major ceremonies, 6 of which marked the important yearly cycles, such as the first new moon of spring, green corn harvest, mature corn harvest, falling leaves festival, and the beginning of winter slash exulting ceremony. Many of these ceremonies are still done today and are as meaningful now, if not more so, than in past times. Ceremonial practice also includes various types of personal, family, community, and national ceremonies that help maintain balance within the individual, the family, the community, and the nation. Number 6. The Laws of Nature. Keen observers, the Cherokee have for thousands of years paid attention to the world around them. This collected body of knowledge is extensive, and it explains why things act as they do and the cause and effect of their interrelationship. Why animals behave certain ways, how the sun and moon interrelate, how men and women interact, the nature of water, the fire, the earth, and so on. Number 7. Conjuring. Although there is no good word in English to describe this, various words such as conjuring, magic, manipulation, partially explain this practice. This is the ability to enlist the aid of spirits and elemental powers to change things, to heal or doctor, to change one's mind, to bring luck, and to protect the sick or weak from negative influences. In some Christian churches, this is called faith healing. There is a Cherokee medicine man that comes into play to assist authorities as we get into this case, so I think knowing about the history and information is really important. Basically, the Cookson Hills is the home to many Cherokee, and the medicine is the focus later. So Camp Scott, as mentioned in the beginning, had been active for 49 years. It was by the Snake Creek and Spring Creek along State Highway 82. The camp sat on 410 acres between Locust Grove and Tahlequah. This land was said to be sacred land to the Native Americans for years and years. Opening day in 1977 was June the 12th, and most of the girls were excited. For some, it was their first year, and they were a little homesick, some just a little nervous. For others, they had attended before. 2 months before camp started, there were training sessions going on, and one of the counselors of the camp discovered that her possessions had been raided. Whoever did this even stole her donuts, and inside the empty donut box was a note. The note stated that 3 girls would be killed. Well, since summer camps are chock full of ghost stories and people sometimes trying to play around and scare people, this note was taken as a prank and thrown to the side, like it was no big deal. Little did they know, this person meant it. 3 little girls out of 140 that rode the bus to Camp Scott on June the 12th were Lori Lee Farmer, she was the youngest of the campers at only 8 years old, Doris Denise Milner, 10 years old, and Michelle Gousset, age 9. Michelle was one of the girls who had been to Camp Scott the year prior, and she was so excited to go back. Michelle was super active and athletic, according to her parents. Lori had a difficult time trying to decide if she really wanted to go to Girl Scout camp or a camp that was sponsored by the Tulsa area YMCA. Lori was over the moon about making new friends. She had 4 siblings, and her dad, Dr. Charles Beau Farmer, was very proud of his amazing daughter. Denise was a straight-A student. She had never attended camp before, but she had sold so many Girl Scout cookies that she was able to go to the camp with some friends. Well, right before camp started, her friends backed out, so it was just Denise going solo. She was so smart that she had been accepted to go to this highly respected and prominent middle school called Carver Middle School. Only the most exceptional were accepted. Her mom said, quote, she was looking forward to school starting in the fall, end quote. Denise was really amped up at first about going to camp. She didn't like the fact that she had to be away from her little 5-year-old sister or her mom. Michelle, Lori, and Denise were in Tent 8 at the Kiowa campgrounds. There was allegedly supposed to be a 4th girl in their tent, but she was moved to another tent. It's important to note that this tent was in a very isolated area, and it was kind of hard to see. The way the camp showers were placed, it made it more difficult to see tent number 8, and it was really far away from the camp counselor's tents. It was around 6 or 7 that evening when a thunderstorm rolled in, and the girls were in their tents, writing to their loved ones, eventually falling asleep. One of the camp counselors said this, which I'll explain why I find this very odd, but I'm not trying to blame her for anything at all. I just think sometimes people make mistakes, and this is something that we know now should have been taken more seriously, but we can never know what's going on in someone's mind when they experience what Carla did that night. So take a listen.
I don't know if I went to sleep or whether I must have. I don't know what time it was, maybe even midnight or past midnight or so. I woke up and I heard noise coming from an area kind of off the road by our tent. It was kind of intermittent. It wasn't continuous. Something like a cross between a frog and a bullhorn or something. It was low and kind of guttural. It wasn't language. It didn't really seem human. It didn't sound like any animal I'd ever heard. So I thought that I better go out and check, and I think I still heard some kids, I don't know. And I woke Dee just momentarily to say, do you hear that? And I was like, it sounds like an animal or something. And so I went out with my flashlight and started walking over that way, and it kind of like how an animal would do if you pointed a light at it and stopped what it was doing, and still couldn't really tell where it was coming from, but it didn't. I guess I'm not too far removed from, you know, the horror movies or whatever. I didn't want to go over and have it jump out of the bush at me or something. So I turned around and went back and walked the tent, walked around the unit, and everything was quiet. All the tents were quiet, and I went back to bed and went to sleep.
The problem that I have with this is that she saw a flashlight, which she may not have known was a flashlight, but when she turned hers off, the other light would come on. She was obviously scared, so I'm not sure why, with all of this unusual activity going on, that there wasn't something done as far as getting the other counselors up to see what was happening, especially when she herself was scared and leery of whatever it was. Even if you found out that it was just an animal, I think all precautions are necessary, but I can't know why she went back to her tent to sleep. I just find that odd and something possibly a lot of people would not do. Everyone is different and thinks differently, and I'm not blaming her. I'm really not. She couldn't have known what was going to happen that night or what was going on. She was spooked and went back to her tent to sleep. I'm sure she regrets that and realizes she probably should have made a different move, but she just didn't know. It just makes me sad because these counselors were responsible for those girls. It could have been an animal, or it could have even been one of the girls out of their tents. I just think it was handled in an incorrect way, and that's only my opinion. I also think that counselors should have been making rounds during the night to check on the girls. All of this is simply my opinion. I know she was scared. It's just a little frustrating. To add to that, there were noises heard that night by girls in surrounding tents and other counselors. Some thought they heard girls cry out for their moms. They brushed it off as girls having nightmares. Others heard strange noises and screams coming from the direction of the girls' tent. So many things were just shrugged off and ignored. The 70s were definitely a different time, but I would have expected these children would have had some kind of security or protection. That night, someone had opened the flaps to a few of the tents, and some of the flaps were taken off of the hook screws, and this person even stole purses and glasses. June 13th, 1977. Carla Wilhite was making her way to take a shower around 6 in the morning. She saw something in the corner of her eye. She spotted sleeping bags. One was yellow plaid, one was green, and the last had a floral design. They were crumpled up on a trail near Tent 8. Carla assumed that somebody delivered some extra luggage and equipment for camp. As she walked towards the sleeping bags, she saw a little girl laying down a little ways off the road. Another camp counselor was called to come look at what Carla saw, and this is what she had to say.
I remember looking around in the woods trying to make some sense out of what was happening, and we had a dead child, and I started to think, well, she must have gotten out of her tent. And could an animal have done that? I just remember not being able to understand, and my counselors and the nurse were beginning to fall apart. And then it dawned on me there were two others missing. As we looked around, when we realized that Denise was dead, we did notice the sleeping bags adjacent to but several yards off. And my husband and one of the camp counselors walked over to the sleeping bags and picked them up, feeling the weight in the individual bags. Richard, my husband, then knelt down and felt through the bags and determined that there were bodies or parts in the bags. The children were so small or had been crumpled so that it was almost unbelievable that there were children in the sleeping bags. So I got on the phone and I called the Highway Patrol right in the phone book of emergency numbers, and I told them that I had need of an ambulance. I had need of three ambulances. I told them that apparently there were three dead children. I said I had no idea if it's a homicide, but that's what I needed.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The night of the thunderstorm, as I told earlier, the girls were writing to their loved ones. Denise Milner wrote to her mother, "Dear Mom, I don't like camp. It's awful. The first day it rained. I have three new friends named Glenda, Lori, and Michelle. Michelle and Lori are my roommates. Mom, I don't want to stay at camp for 2 weeks. I want to come home and see Cassie and everybody. Your loving child, Denise Milner." Lori's letter read, "Dear Mom and Dad, and Misty, and Joe, and Chad, and Kathy, we're just getting ready to go to bed. It's 7:45. We're at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met two new friends, Michelle Gousset and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now, 'cause there's hardly anything else to do. With love, Lori." Michelle's letter said, "Dear Aunt Karen, how are you? I'm fine. I'm writing from camp. We can't go outside because it is storming. Me and my tent mates are in our unit. My tent mates are Denise Milner and Lori Farmer. My room is in shades of purple. Love, Michelle. The Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, or as you'll hear me call them, the OSBI, came to the scene and were the head of the investigation. Sadly, not long after the girls wrote their loved ones and fell asleep, they never would have guessed they wouldn't make it to see the morning sunrise. Lori Farmer and Michelle Gousset were beaten to death. Denise Milner had been strangled, with her face beaten. She was naked from her waist down, and her small hands were duct-taped behind her back. Two of them were raped, and one had been sodomized. After they had been murdered, the killer put their lifeless bodies in sleeping bags and left them on a trail that led to the shower. The killer made a weak attempt to clean up some of the blood on the floor of the tent with towels and mattress covers. He also stuffed those in the sleeping bags. Michelle was killed one day before her parents' anniversary. Here's what Michelle's parents said about Michelle and how they found out about her death.
She was very excited, and she came downstairs and sat on my lap and told me that she was going to miss me, but she wanted to make sure that I would take care of her plants. Her African violets were her specialty, and she wanted to make sure that I would water them and take care of them.
And Michelle was kind of funny because it was like a premonition that she kissed us goodbye, but she wanted to be kind of like herself. She was like that she was going away and never going to come back.
They knocked on the door, and they said that they had something to tell me and about Michelle. And I said, is there a problem? And they said, we need to come in. And they introduced themselves, you know. And I said, is she hurt? And they said, well, come in and sit down. And then it was at that point, they said that there had been an accident at camp. And they never did tell me that she had been murdered.
A friend of mine came here and kind of helped me fight off the press. We had a very, and I would say, obnoxious person from the newspaper came to the door and demanded a picture. And at that point, I probably was going to punch him out, but I didn't think that would be the smartest thing to do. So we went ahead and we got a picture and gave it to him. Not the real, the picture I feel was the best of Michelle, but the one that I would be willing to give up. We finally turned the TV on. That's how we learned how she died.
Now hear what Lori's parents had to say.
And I received a call from the executive director of the Girl Scout organization. And later we found out that we were the third people that she called. First she called their insurance company, then she called their attorney, then she called us. She told me that in a very brief statement, basically, that Lori and two other girls were found dead out some distance behind their tent. No explanation, nothing else, not that there was any violence involved.
I had a hard time not letting her go this particular year because everyone was going somewhere to camp. She wasn't real adamant about it being Girl Scout camp. She wanted to go somewhere to A camp, and she had actually picked two, the Y camp and Girl Scout camp. Primarily, I was the one who chose the Girl Scout camp over the Y camp. And that's something that I have to deal with myself, in that was my decision. Also, the week that Lori went to camp was my decision. And that's a decision that rests pretty heavily with me.
And lastly, this is what Denise's mom said.
She was getting worried about going. She had decided she really didn't want to go. She wasn't sure that she would like it. But I convinced her that she should go and try it, that it would help her be more independent, and that if she didn't like it, all she had to do was call and we would come and get her, and that she didn't have to stay. Her little sister, Kathy, was only 5 then, and at the time I didn't think much about what she was saying because I felt like she was just wanting attention because Denise was getting so much attention. She asked me what happens when people die. And I tried to explain it to her the best I could. And she said, well, what if everybody dies? And I told her that people are being born every day. So the world just continues, you know, because as people die, other people are being born. So she said, Mama, tomorrow everybody's going to die. And they were dead the next day.
The other Girl Scouts were not told about the murders, and they were sent on a bus back to their parents. This is what Michael Wilkerson, an OSBI agent, had to say about the scene.
This was a crime scene like none I had ever been to before. The best way to describe it would be the reverence of a church. People were talking in low whispers. They were quiet. As I look back at it now, I don't even recall birds singing. We walked over and there were 2 bags. I know the first thing I was struck by is how tiny, tiny, tiny the figures were in the sleeping bags. I don't know why I never related, at least to myself, that these were tiny, tiny children. They took up only one small portion of the sleeping bag. And laying near the sleeping bag was a little black girl about probably 10 years old. And somebody had covered her with one of the sleeping bags. We opened the first sleeping bag, and there was a tiny little blonde-headed girl laying in the sleeping bag. And I remember Carrie, as he snapped the picture, as we opened the sleeping bag, all he could say is, my God, my God. And they declared her dead. Then we checked the third bag, which contained another little small girl, darker headed, who was bound with her hands behind her back. And, of course, she was dead, too.
Larry Bowles, a Cherokee and one of the OSBI agents, also spoke on the tragedy.
I'd investigated a lot of homicides before this, but I wasn't really ready for what I saw. It was obvious they had been sexually assaulted. There was an overkill. Excessive force was used to subdue these little girls. Then when Dr. Hoffman got to the third sleeping bag, he unzipped it, and it was Lori Farmer. And he opened the sleeping bag and laid the side of it back. And I'll never forget what she looked like. She looked like she was asleep. And I thought maybe she'd wake up. But I knew that wasn't possible. She was just at peace. She had a flashlight stuck between her legs, just like she went to sleep and wanted to make sure that she could find a flashlight, you know, should she need it during the night. But she was lying there, so at peace, just like a little baby asleep. And I kept wanting her to wake up because I could see no injuries on her. And I thought, you know, she can't be dead. And I took her out of the sleeping bag, laid her on the table. I still saw no injuries. And as I looked at her in the sleeping bag, the only thing I was hoping for, after I finally convinced myself that she was dead, I was hoping that maybe at least one of the little girls hadn't been sexually assaulted. Maybe just one of them hadn't been. And as the medical examiner pulled the sleeping bag away from her, I could see her panties had been pulled up and they were twisted to one side. And I knew then she would never wear her underpants that way. And I knew that she had probably been sexually assaulted.
The evidence beside their bodies consisted of a roll of black duct tape, nylon rope, and a red and white 9-volt flashlight. The lens of the flashlight was wrapped with a bit of green plastic that was from a trash bag. Whoever it was used masking tape to stick on the green plastic to the flashlight. There was also a pair of red-laced underwear. Oddly, there were prescription glasses just scattered all around the campground. Also, don't forget this minor detail. The person who slaughtered these girls would try on female glasses, and if they weren't the right prescription for the killer, they'd just throw them down. This weird little detail will circle back around later. There was a newspaper shoved inside the flashlight where the batteries were. The paper was the Tulsa World newspaper from April 17th. Investigators also found that there were things stolen that night. There were purses missing, glasses, and sunglasses that belonged to Susan Emery, a camp counselor. One of the things that law enforcement did was investigate mental hospitals and prisons all around the state. They were checking the list of outpatients and parolees that had a past of sex crimes. Some of the evidence, such as the rope and duct tape, were found to be stolen from a farmhouse about a mile away. The farmer that lived there passed a lie detector test, but he was slandered in the newspaper that week. They put the farmer's picture in the paper and the heading was Slayer. He had to be put in the hospital after he had a lot of prank calls and the media wouldn't leave him alone. With an additional inspection of the girls' bodies, they discovered fingerprints and one single hair, thought to be that of the culprit. The hair did come from someone that was Native American. There were tracking dogs eventually called the Wonder Dogs that investigators had flown in from Pennsylvania. There was an 8-month-old case and reportedly one of the dogs picked the correct suspect out of a lineup. They said these dogs could probably find the killer within 2 days. However, one of the agents was told a medicine man had put a death curse on the dogs. Most dismissed this as a bogus claim. It couldn't be real, right? It's impossible, isn't it? Harvey Pratt was an agent who is also a Cheyenne Arapaho. He believed highly in Native American medicine men and women. He took this death curse very seriously. Here's a little of what Harvey Pratt had to say.
When I get involved in those investigations of Indians who were talking and the rumors that we heard during the investigation of the little girls that were coming out of the Indian culture, especially since that was a heavily concentration of Native Americans up in there. So we started getting a lot of that, and I started picking up a lot of that. And I had to consider that, especially of things after I had learned on my own through the investigation that led towards Indian culture and towards Indian suspects.
Michael Wilkerson wrote a book about the murders and about Harvey Pratt. He wrote, quote, "The Indians in this part of Oklahoma believe that medicine men have medicine so strong that they can change themselves into birds or animals or give someone else this power," end quote. Harvey believed in shapeshifters and skinwalkers. Not long after they were told about the curse put on the dogs, one of the dogs died out of the blue. Some of the agents tried to chalk this up to the dog possibly overheating, but eventually, all of the dogs died. Harvey Pratt made his way down a creek one night and decided to perform a medicinal ceremony, smoking himself with cedar, making a fire and putting the cedar in. the smoke covering himself and gliding through the air, while he prayed. This is the Native American way of getting rid of impurities in your spirit, and it makes your thoughts more apparent. All of a sudden, three agents appear, and they ask what he's doing and if they can take part in this holy ritual. Harvey answered them, and Dick Wilkerson, assistant director of the OSBI, is also in this audio clip that I want to play for you now.
I said, well, yeah, you can. I think it's great. That's fine. I also had some additional medicine at that time that I had gotten from a medicine man that said that it would be used to seek help and gain help for you whenever you were looking for this killer, that this medicine would help you. And so I took this Indian medicine that was given to me, and I put it in the fire, knowing that the smoke was going to go up into the skies and go all over. And I told him, I said, this medicine will go out, and it's to help us. Somebody's going to touch, and they're going to help us. They're going to come forward and help us solve this case, give us some information. So we all smoked together as brothers, a regular cigarette, tobacco, without a filter. And the phone rang. The phone rang from our mobile headquarters, and it was
Jerry Sunderland, who was a former OSBI agent who was a warden at Granite Reformatory, saying that at least one of the women could be identified.
It happened immediately after that fire, after we did that ceremony. And they asked me, several of them asked me if I was a medicine man at that point, because it was just, I was amazing the way it happened. I was blown away. I was really surprised. And so were they. I could see it in their faces.
OSBI agent Arthur Linville had his own suspicions of a convicted rapist and outlaw, a Cherokee Native American named Gene Leroy Hart. His mom only lived maybe less than half a mile from Camp Scott. In 1966, Gene admitted that he had kidnapped, tied up, raped, and sodomized two pregnant women in Tulsa. Gene was to be in prison for 3 10-year sentences, but the sentences ran at the same time, so he was paroled after 28 months. One of the victims also spoke about a weird sound he would make that were possibly the same sounds heard by Carla Wilhite that night. And he took the victim's glasses. He tried to smother his victim with tape over her nose, and she was bound. He covered her with brush and dirt. She managed to somehow get the tape off of her nose. She says that was definitely an act of God helping her. In 1970, Gene Hart was put away for a string of home robberies and sentenced to a max of 305 years in the state penitentiary at McAllister. April 1973, he was taken from McAllister to the Mays County Jail in Pryor, Oklahoma, so he could appear for post-conviction relief in his 1966 crime. He did flee from the jail, but was seized a month later. September 1973, Gene got away again, and at the time of the murders, he was still on the run. 4 years later, and he was still, unfortunately, really good at hiding from the law. 3 days after the tragic murders, two squirrel hunters came upon a random sack of flour in front of a cave. This cave was only 3 miles from the camp. The squirrel hunters called the cops because they had a feeling someone may be occupying this cave, possibly some kind of hideout. There was a lot discovered in this cave. There was a picture of two women, masking tape with a little bit of a trash bag attached to it, pieces of newspaper, which was the Tulsa World newspaper from April 17th, a pair of shattered sunglasses that were inside of a sunglasses case. They belonged to the camp counselor, Susan Emery. The pictures found in the cave were linked to Louise Lindsay. When Jean was locked up in the prison, she worked there at the same time. She had a second job as a photographer. She was the one that developed these pictures. Gene somehow got his hands on these pictures, and it's suspected that Gene kept them because one of the ladies in the picture looked similar to his wife. Now, a connection was made, and that cave that the squirrel hunters came across was now a part of the crime scene, with Gene Hart officially connected to that cave. The person that did this to the little girls would have to know the ins and outs of the Cookson Hills. Gene Hart would be one of those people who knew the area very well. Cookson Hills would be very difficult for a random person to navigate. A farmer spotted a man sitting in a cave, and he apparently alerted authorities because Harvey Pratt went to investigate. This is where, again, the number four comes into play.
And I noticed immediately was that first fire. And then when I looked, I noticed that there were other little fires scattered around it, kind of in a half a circle, back coming around this way and to circle it up, four fires. Four is very significant in Indian culture, for the four seasons, the four directions, winds, four major colors, things like that, that are used in ceremonies. And I noticed the cigarette butts, and we found a book of matches, and I saw the cigarette butts, and I noticed that the filters had been snapped off of them. Well, you know, to me that meant something, because I was aware that sometimes when you smoke among Indians, and they smoke for a reason, and they're going to cement or consecrate something, they would smoke. We're going to smoke over this. It's good medicine. We're going to smoke over it. I break the filter off to get rid of the if they don't have a pipe or their own tobacco, they would take away that last piece of civilization and throw the filter away and smoke it direct of a cigarette. Well, I noticed there was a couple of butts that had the filters had been broken off, and then the filters, a couple of pieces, and then I saw the remains of the little pieces of cedar branches, you know, and at that point I assumed and felt relatively sure in my mind that someone was down there that was an Indian and had used this as either to purify or to sanctify himself and smoked over it. And I think that's what that cave was for. The man had used that to help himself. Indian medicine.
Harvey Pratt's younger brother was also a police officer, and he wanted him to assist in the investigation. The two were doing undercover work. Harvey wanted his brother to be with him because he was familiar and comfortable with the ways of the Native American beliefs and practices. One night, they went to a medicine man, and they asked him for help. They asked the medicine man to help them find this killer. The medicine man handed them medicine for their bullets. This would make the bullet hit the guilty one, and it would be a more perfect shot. The medicine man also gave Harvey medicine to hide and medicine to track people. So, if Harvey was on the right track and sprinkled this medicine around the trail of the killer, he'd be on the culprit the whole way and never lose this person. Harvey was apprehensive because he was brought up in the Native American culture, and he didn't have doubts, really, of shape-shifting. Gene Hart would brag in jail about dodging cops above and below. Harvey was worried because the threats of the tracking dogs being cursed and dying came to fruition. Harvey and his brother spent many nights in the hills with this medicine man. They were talking about how they were worried about Gene changing into animals. They had a fire going one night, and all of a sudden a cat jumped on Harvey and screamed. After this, the cat disappeared into the night. It shook Harvey and his brother for the rest of the night, and needless to say, they didn't get much sleep. Investigators even saw on many different occasions a black dog that would follow them places, then mysteriously vanish. A lot of people who have went to the property in recent years still say there's a mysterious black dog they've seen wandering the property. Many people do believe it's Gene Hart. An informant came to one of the investigators and gave him some information on Gene Hart. The informant told him Gene had been going to visit a medicine man as well. One thing about medicine men is that they don't judge another. If a person needs help or to hide out, they will let them move in with them. A problem arose in the case of Gene Hart being the guilty one. The girls had been sexually assaulted and sperm samples were taken. However, Gene had gone through a vasectomy. At this time, they had no idea that Gene's vasectomy was actually botched. So investigators got super frustrated because somehow Gene Hart managed to evade over 40 FBI agents, highway patrol, investigators, and so many other professionals. Somebody knows something. What the investigators decided to do was go interrogate the medicine man's wife. Here's the audio recording of what they said to her.
I want the man that killed three little Girl Scouts, and you all are hiding him. If you're playing a game with us, we're three playing games. We're starting to indict people. We know a lot about you, and like I said, I'm not interested in you all, but we're interested in Gene Leroy Hart, and we want him. And if you don't cooperate with me today, you're going to be indicted by a federal grand jury. And if it's a game to you, I can assure you, stop being fun right now. I can tell you one more thing. That up to this point, the three fathers of these little girls, they're pretty uptight. Even though it's been almost a year ago, they're still pretty uptight about it. One's a police officer, one's a doctor, one's a businessman in Tulsa. They have been calling us repeatedly, wanting to know. They know that we know who the mediator is. We haven't given any names. But I can assure you, by the time the sun goes down tonight, they're going to know your names and your addresses.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Their work had paid off. She told them where he could be found, and they traveled to the location in an unmarked van and surrounded the little shack that Gene was in. The back door was open, and Gene poked his head out. The investigator could have easily shot Gene, but he didn't. Gene jumped back inside of the little house, and they rushed in. Gene was going to run, but one of the investigators asked him, "Do you want to die today?" Gene froze. They finally had this elusive man in handcuffs. Gene didn't have any shoes on, and Harvey believed the tracking medicine that he used was on the soles of Gene's feet. To let this be known, he touched the sole of Gene's feet, and there it was. Harvey took back the medicine that was actually on the bottom of Gene's feet. That part of the documentary kind of gave me chills, not even gonna lie. As one of the investigators grabbed Gene and hoisted him up off of the floor, he asked him, "You killed those little girls, didn't you?" And Gene simply responded with, "You'll never pin it on me." Gene Hart was even wearing women's glasses when he was arrested. The tape that was used to constrain Denise Milner's hands had a piece of hair on it, and it was a similar but not exact match to Gene's. This is also when they realized Gene's vasectomy was unsuccessful. Gene's blood type was O. The semen sample that was taken from the victims was also from a non-white male with blood type O, and it contained abnormal sperm. The amount of people in the U.S. who meet all of that criteria embody 0.002% of the populace. But all of this evidence was only similar and minuscule, not exactly alike. After all, Gene told the investigators that they'd never pin it on him. He may have been right. This was all before DNA testing, so they could only go on what little evidence they had and could piece together the best that they could. The women's glasses that he would take, all of this seemed like little evidence when looked at separately, but when it all was put together, it formed a much bigger picture. The support for Gene Hart was unbelievable. All of his friends, family, and people that didn't really even know him that well didn't believe he was capable of these murders. Which doesn't quite make sense. If he was capable of rape and sodomy of two pregnant women, what makes people think he didn't have it in him to kill? The people that supported Gene said he was just the scapegoat by the white establishment. They even raised money for Gene's defense. Their cars and trucks had bumper stickers on them that said, "The Heart of Gene Country." The American Indian Movement sent over delegates to observe the conditions of what was going on. Things were getting a little out of hand by people who were outraged, and then, on top of that, you had the media frenzy. Gene Hart even did an interview that aired on television. Here's what he had to say.
I am not a hero. I have no desire to be a hero. But maybe I represent the fears and doubts that many people have about any system that has the means and the power to overwhelm each of us, each and every one of us.
The prosecution asked for a change of venue, somewhere more neutral, but that was denied and Gene Hart's trial started in March of 1979. Special Prosecutor Buddy Fallis Jr. was chosen to aid District Attorney Sid Wise, who was scrutinized because he was going to reportedly write a book about this case. Garvin Isaacs was paid to be Gene's defense attorney. As far as the jury, there was not even one who was Native American. After the murders took place, Gene moved in with an elderly man named Sam Pigeon. There were two things used as evidence that were found in Sam's home. There was a corncob pipe and a little blue mirror. Those two items belonged to a training camp counselor, Karen Mitchell. She said they disappeared the night of the murders. However, there was a slight error made by investigators that screwed this all up. They retrieved these items during the second search of Sam's house. Sam claimed he'd never seen the mirror or the corncob pipe before. So it was suspected by everyone that supported Gene and his attorney that the Oklahoma State Bureau investigators had planted them in the house. Isaacs also called into question the reliability and truthfulness of Pete Weaver, the Mays County Sheriff. One of the sheriff's previous guards, Alan Little, stated he had spotted Gene's belongings in Pete Weaver's desk. These belongings ended up being in the cave that the OSBI thought Gene was hiding out in after the slayings. After 6 days of testimony, the prosecution rested their case. The defense didn't attack the state's evidence at all. Isaacs talked about someone he thought was a suspect in this murder, Bill Stevens. He was a convicted rapist. Joyce Ellen Payne and her partner, Dwayne Peters, knew Bill. They claimed that Bill had asked for a flashlight and they lent him their red and white flashlight just a few days before the girls were killed. After he came back to their house, they thought Bill had blood on his boots. Bill explained that he had some car issues in Locust Grove. Of course, Bill said all of this was untrue and he wasn't even in that vicinity. However, one of the Girl Scouts at the camp, Kimberly Lewis, testified that she actually saw a man that looked an awful like Bill Stevens at the camp. The prosecution said that Bill couldn't be the one who did it, due to the semen and hair samples. It dismissed Bill from being a suspect. There was also the possibility that more than one person may have been involved, since there were three girls murdered. You may not be able to do all of that alone. There was, in fact, a 9.5-size shoe print found in blood on the floor of the girls' tent. Some suspect a woman could have been involved that helped Jean. One of the mothers of the little girls says she has always had a feeling that a woman helped him. They never found out who the shoe print belonged to, unfortunately. The jury didn't decide what the verdict was right away. They all went home that night and would resume the next morning. However, that night at 11 p.m., the sheriff called on Crying Wolf, a medicine man, to help him. The sheriff was highly upset that a lot of people thought that he was railroading Jean Hart and saying they had planted evidence. So the two men met up at the courtyard, and the sheriff asked if there was a medicine that could help tell if someone was guilty or lying. Well, there was. The medicine is called the Ancient One, or the Old One, which could determine who was lying and who was not. This is what Crying Wolf says in the documentary. His voice is altered to protect his identity.
Jean Hart stood on me, on the blood of those little girls. And told God Almighty that he didn't do this. And there was other people, if you will, on the other side of the fence, standing on that same blood, and said, Jean Hart did this. And to use that old tobacco to bring this out was the ultimate purpose.
The important number 4 comes back into play as the ancient medicine was scattered around the four corners of the courthouse as Crying Wolf prayed for the ultimate truth.
The ultimate truth is life and death. And this is the ultimate test of the ancient one to determine if Jean Hart or another person would die as a result of this terrible thing that was done.
Please remember what he just said. The next morning, the jury was ready to reveal their verdict. Jean Hart was declared not guilty. The reactions from the supporters, loud cheering. The victims' families and their supporters, shock and sadness. The jury said there was cause for reasonable doubt. The evidence just wasn't there and, quote-unquote, the investigation was a screwed-up mess. After Jean's trial, he had to go back to prison to resume his sentence for robbery. Within a year, Jean had a massive heart attack and died. It's suspected that he was poisoned by another inmate. Dick Wilkerson said, quote, a large amount of cyanide was confiscated from prisoners at McAllister State Prison the day before Hart died. End quote. However, Crying Wolf said, whoever was guilty would die. It depends on what your beliefs are. I tend to lean towards Crying Wolf and the ancient medicine because of my own Native American background. However, I know we all have different opinions and beliefs, and I completely respect that. The day Jean died was actually important. It was the anniversary, almost to the hour, when he had taken those pregnant women and raped them. It was also a June evening when he had robbed two Tulsa houses. And on a June night, those three amazing and bright little girls had their lives taken. Coincidence? Maybe. Crying Wolf said that it was also a significant date of death because it was June the 4th. Jean Leroy Hart died at 34 years old. No one else was ever charged with the Girl Scout murders. Ted Lemke, OSBI inspector, once said there was no need to keep the case open because the jury had quote-unquote turned loose the man who committed the murders. In 2007, the Oklahoma State Crime Lab ran DNA tests on evidence from the case, but the results were inconclusive. Camp Scott has been closed down since the day they found Denise, Michelle, and Lori. Richard Gousset went on to help the state legislator to pass the Oklahoma Victims' Bill of Rights. Sherry Farmer founded the Oklahoma chapter of the support group Parents of Murdered Children. To this day, there are many people who think Jean Hart was in fact innocent and set up. There are hardcore debates on each side of the fence. What do you believe? Thank you for listening to today's episode. As always, I want to shout out my awesome patrons at patreon.com/reverietruecrime. Thank you so much, Chelsea, Emily, Trevor, Brandy, Ian, Maggie, Matt, Shayna, Liz, Madeline, Lorraine, Kara, Melissa, and Denise. However you have chosen to support me, even just by listening to these episodes, please know that I appreciate every single one of you. I hope you are staying warm, social distancing, and always staying safe out there because I love ya. Oklahomicide, Slayings in the Sooner State, is a true crime podcast hosted by Dr. Stacy Hughes that delves into the murderous acts of Oklahomans across the Sooner State. So if you'd like to hear more stories out of the Sooner State, please go subscribe to Oklahomicide,